Hello and welcome to episode 38 of Jughead's Hello and welcome to episode 39 of Jughead's Basement, subgenre lo-fi interviews with hi-fi guests. Today I bring you an old antiqued interview I did with Dan Panic for the second episode I ever did for this podcast, an episode on Screeching Weasel's My Brain Hurts. This is a mostly unedited interview, and the beginning you will hear the old or ye old song I used to use for the beginning of the podcast, which is a song called Johnny's Out of Control by D.I. It was my friend Matt Nelson's favorite punk song, and we actually even named our DJ company where we did weddings and high school dances. We called it Out of Control. And then Matt Nelson actually took that name and started, he took over the booking that Ben and I were doing at Dirty Nelly's, and he started booking there and calling his company Out of Control, which eventually moved on to McGregor's and helped book many, many bands like Crimp Shrine, Toxic Reasons, The Vindictives, Screeching Weasels, Smoking Popes, who will have an episode coming up soon. Green Day was there. So many bands Matt helped bring to Chicago. Sadly, he passed away quite a few years ago now. So you will hear that, and then you will hear my intro that I gave to Panic's interview when I released it a long time ago. I did some outtakes of Vapid's and Panic's interviews and released them, but then I took them off, about 4 or 5 years ago, and now I'm re-releasing it. So here is me and Dan Panic talking in October of 2012. So here's the beginning. Johnny's out of control. Thank you.
Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem, he's out of control.
When I decided to use My Brain Hurts on my radio show, immediately it became a vehicle to reconnect with the people and the memories that for the last couple of years I had tried not to think about. Listening back to both Vapid and Panic's interviews, I realized on many occasions the three of us had conflated different tours into one. After years of working together, the experiences begin to co-mingle, and generic band experiences begin to mingle with unique experiences. For instance, I kept insisting that Panic was in the ashtray in Oakland, California with me, but actually, that was Warren Fish and Steve Cheese on a much earlier tour. The punk house that Panic will be talking about is not the punk house that I am simultaneously talking about, but as you will see, it will seem as if we are talking about the same tour and the same house. Nonetheless, the feelings, smells, and images remain intact. So here is the mostly unedited recording of me and Panic reminiscing about My Brain Hurts, Wiggle, and Anthem for a New Tomorrow.
Hello, Dan.
Hi, John.
Can you hear me clear?
Yes.
Ah, yes. I decided to go without the video because it's actually a better signal when it's just the audio. It's not that I don't want to see you.
Oh, that's okay. That's more comfortable that way for me.
So I'm going to start out with some back history of you, and then we'll move up to the My Brain Hurts. But my first question is, when did you start drumming, and did you imagine you would be drumming for bands for as long as you have?
You know, for me, drumming came a bit later into my life. I never had any aspirations as far as making a career out of it. You know, when I expressed interest in playing drumming with bands, I was met with a lot of resistance with family and friends saying I'd never be able to do it. And being the contrarian that I am, I thought, well, I have to do this now. That pretty much inspired me to do it more than anything. It was pretty much intimated to me that it wasn't going to happen. And I thought, well, this is a nice little challenge. I'm going to do it.
Were you, did you actually have drum rhythm lessons, or did you just start out fresh on your own?
Start off fresh.
Yeah. Did you just purchase your own drum set and
yep.
just get going?
Yep.
How old were you when you started?
I don't really remember. It wasn't too long before I joined you guys.
So you were Ivy League right before that, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So,
mm-hmm. so. But I'd always been tapping, annoying people in classrooms, but drumming on desks and everything like that. So I think it was probably natural for me to become a drummer, much to the annoyance of other human beings. But I think it was, in a way, too, I think drumming was a little cathartic because I was very timid, a little bit more passive-aggressive, didn't know how to express myself very well to people. So I think playing drums was a good way to just, you know, good therapy for me, just beat the hell out of the drums, make a little noise.
I remember seeing you in Ivy League. I don't remember what show it was, but I remember Ben and I were discussing. Were you at that reunion show?
Yeah, we actually played with you guys.
Because
it was Ivy League, Apocalypse, Hoboken, and you guys. And that was the first time I saw Screeching Weasel. And to me, Screeching Weasel was already, like, I really liked the melodic pop punk songs more than the hardcore songs. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was some of the best stuff out of Chicago. When I saw you guys play live, I really liked the humor, dressing up in ridiculous clothes, then baiting the audience and watching people get really annoyed and upset. And I laughed. And I remember I was standing next to Mark Ruvolo in the audience, and Ben was on one of his rants. And I just saw the humor in it, and I was laughing my ass off. And Mark Ruvolo just looked at me like, he actually gets it. He's one of the few people in the audience who thinks the whole thing is ridiculous and funny and whatnot.
I would like your opinion of how did you end up in Screeching Weasel?
I had gotten Ben's phone number from him, and I remember talking to him sporadically over a short period of time. I think I talked to him twice. And once Ivy League broke up, I thought that was going to be it for me for drumming. And then I was looking to do something different. I remember talking to him about it. I was looking at doing something similar to the Smiths. But he had mentioned that he was going to put a project together and if I was going to be interested in doing it. And like I said, I really like Screeching Weasel's music. So I'm like, sure, I'd be interested. And I didn't really think that anything would come of it, and I really, really surprised when I got a phone call, and we all got together and played for the first time. I was really happy.
Yeah, me too. Now, you're from the West Side, which suburb?
Villa Park.
Villa Park, you're from.
Originally, I was born and raised for a brief time in this South Side of Chicago, and then my parents, we relocated to Villa Park. Hmm.
Now, I think from the beginning, we started rehearsing at your house. Is that correct?
I think we did two rehearsals at Dave Lally's house. And then I think his father wasn't too keen on the idea, so we went over to my folks' house.
Yeah, and just to give some of the audience a view, the West Side, a lot of the more the straight-edge bands came out of that sort of area. Do you remember why, or do you know why?
I have no idea, because at that point, I wasn't that familiar with the punk underground. When I joined Ivy League, I was exposed to Crimp Shrine, Operation Ivy, bands like that. But before that, the bands that I listened to were Dead Kennedys, The Minutemen, The Ramones, Sex Pistols, stuff like that. But as far as the straight edge movement, I knew nothing about it until the bass player came to practice one day and he had these X's on his hands. And I asked him, what the hell is that? He's like, it's straight edge. I'm like, what the hell is straight edge? And it's like, you know, don't drink, don't smoke, you know, and whatnot. And I thought, oh, okay, that's kind of odd to scrawl X's on your hands, but okay.
So you weren't a part of that movement at all on the
No, and that's the funny thing was even then I didn't drink or smoke or do drugs or any of that, and they were trying to like, oh come on, you know, you're essentially straight edge. I'm like, I don't want to join a movement.
Yeah, I remember you and I, you got along pretty well on that aspect, because I think we were the ones that were consistently not really drinking much in those days, and I felt the same way. It's like, it's no movement for me, it's just the way it was at the time.
And then what really kind of concerned me, when they all started wearing Letterman's jackets, and I thought, wow, so the guys who didn't make the football team are now prancing around in Letterman's jackets. And, you know, and I don't have a problem with straight edge whatsoever, but I thought there were, you know, whenever anything gets really militant, the whole philosophy gets a little bit more perverted. And I've been to a couple of the shows, straight edge shows, see what it was like, and they were the most violent pits I'd ever seen. Yeah. And just angry guys. And I think, you know, if one chooses to drink or not to drink or, you know, whatever they want to do, that's fine. But I think once you start repressing yourself to a certain degree, it's going to come out in some form. And I saw a lot of violence and anger because of that. You know, it kind of reminded me of growing up Catholic. And, you know, it's not helping me become the person I want to be. It's hindering me. I bailed.
I think that's one of why I think that core group, the Weasel, during that time got along so well, too, because we all had this sort of, well, very different personalities, but we all had this idea of we had to bring humor back into into the movement. I think it was so important to me. And it wasn't just that we just wanted to be stupid. It's like you could still have a message. You just had to have sort of a humor about it, or else you'd be taken too seriously and that would break you eventually.
Yeah, and I think once you lose a sense of humor about yourself, it's pretty much over, and you know, and life would be miserable without humor. And I always looked at people like Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, Bill Hicks, Mort Sahl, just I felt were kind of the saints of society, because they were able to attack society yet make people laugh about it as well. And so those were people I always held in high regard, and I think within the punk scene too. I think the whole thing of, you know, wearing dresses on stage or getting naked, for me it was about how did this dork from the western suburbs end up in a band like this, you know? And I thought it was really healthy to go on stage and wear a dress and or nothing at all, just to mock the whole thing, because I thought it needed to.
Do you remember at any the point where, because you were a very lively drummer and just your expressions and all that, was there any forethought, or that just sort of happened, that you're restricted to being behind drums? What did that feel like?
I think it just kind of happened. I think just with the attitude of everyone else in the band and having a sense of humor, and I think it was my way of communicating with people in the audience, because I didn't really care to be, you know, sometimes you'd see a band live and they wouldn't even acknowledge the audience, and I felt like, you know, I want to acknowledge the audience, I want to make people laugh if I can, and it's again kind of mocking the whole thing of being on stage and you're supposed to be a rock star.
What were some of the things that you think that you tried to do behind the drums while you could still be drumming?
Whatever I could. I was probably busy trying to play the two drum beats that I knew. But I stood on my drums before, I think during the St. Hawaii.
Oh, yeah.
The Wipeout middle section. And I was surfing on the drums, jumping on them to running around them.
I remember you running around the drums too. Yeah, it was pretty great that you can get back to the rhythms and allow yourself to be so goofy.
Yeah, there were times where I didn't think I'd make it in time. Like, oh, I really put myself in the suit now. And like, I got 0.1 seconds to get over there and finish the song.
We had already recorded with Weasel Fathead Slogans and I Want to Be a Homosexual before you were in the band. And I don't remember that time period. Did we just give you a tape of those and you learned them, or did we teach you live? Do you have any recollection?
Yeah, Ben actually gave me a tape of those songs. I learned them exactly the way that they were recorded. With any song that I learned, I tried to emulate what the drummer was doing on there. And there were a few changes here and there, but not too many. That was one of the things that I enjoyed about our first practice. I had a couple of extra cymbals, too, I remember we played the first couple of songs, and like, well, I'm not going to need this cymbal. And I play a couple more, like, I'm not going to need this cymbal. So I guess to give myself some credit, you know, I'm kind of a drummer who hates drums. I've never wanted a big drum kit or a drum solo or anything like that. I just wanted to play what was needed, and I knew that I probably wouldn't go down in music history as one of the great drummers of all time, but I didn't really care. My drum influences were Ringo Starr, Charlie Watts, Tommy Rabone, people like that who played what was needed. George Hurley from the Minutemen's another one. Bill Stevenson with his drum fills. I mean, my attitude was just play what was needed and pretty much nothing more. And it's still my philosophy today. I mean, I could play all sorts of crazy time signatures and drum fills and everything, but what's the point? You know, and that point, then you just start having conversations with other drummers after the show, you know, and you start talking about Dream Theater or Steely Dan, and I'm not interested. I remember getting into a fight with a guy at a Guitar Center, not a physical one. I was picking up drumsticks, and this was in California when I was in a band called the Plus Ones, and we walked in there, and there was a Neil Peart video, instructional drum video, Neil Peart from Rush. The bass player, Joel, he said, "Zanny, it's your favorite drummer." And I just kind of, I guess I created a cardinal sin at Guitar Center, probably the first commandment of the drum department at Guitar Center, by not stating that Neil Peart was my favorite drummer of all time. You know, he's a phenomenal drummer. I would love to talk to him about literature because he loves, you know, literature. And he's a great drummer for what he does, but it's not something I ever aspired to become. So the guy behind the counter kind of looked like Mickey Thomas from Starship. And he kind of gave me this look. "What do you mean he's not your favorite drummer? You don't like him?" I'm like, "No." "Like, who's your favorite drummer?" "Charlie Watts." And he had the temerity to ask me, "Who's he?" "He's the drummer for the Rolling Stones." And he said, "Well, he just plays the drum beat." "That's the drummer's job." So I wanted to kill him. He wanted to kill me. I did drumsticks before we started duking it out on the floor. But how do you not know who Charlie Watts is and be a drummer? It's like, without Ringo Starr and Charlie Watts, there'd be no Neil Peart. And even he would probably admit that, you know? I just don't get that.
And you notice, too, that those drummers are the ones that are, like, used the most. Like, I mean, you, of course, have been in so many bands because everyone wants to, like, wow, that guy can do a lot with a small amount of drums. And all of a sudden, you're in almost every other Lookout punk band.
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of funny because, I mean, like I said, I didn't expect to do anything with music. Like, my only goal was to record an album and do one tour. So once My Brain Hurts was done and we did the tour, I was ready to, you know, I was all ready to hang it up because I thought, okay, I guess I'm done now. I didn't expect to carry on with it. And I kept, you know, I'd get people asking me to, "Hey, would you mind doing this and mind doing that?" And I thought, well, yeah, you know, and I grabbed just about any opportunity that I had because I just figured I'm going to wake up one day and that's it. So I'm just as surprised as anybody else. They're probably wondering, like, how did he get to play in all these bands? I asked the same question.
My memories for the My Brain Hurts records specifically start with learning What We Hate, which is my favorite song on the record. And I know I have images of us in your basement. And at that point, that's or at least in retrospect, that's where I got this feeling that there was something special about this song and about this group and its incarnation. Do you have any moments that you can recollect where you thought that, wow, there's something special about this group of people?
I think really it dawned on me, because to me it was a bit of a whirlwind, because I'd never been in a proper band before, so this was all new to me, like people taking an interest in something that I was a part of. So it was a bit of a learning curve for me, and then going on tour. What really cemented it was when the recording was finished, and we were at that punk house in Oakland, and we were listening to it on someone's boombox, and there were some people coming in and out and listening to it, and just listening to the final album, I thought, wow, it's probably my favorite Screeching Weasel album, mm-hmm. because it's just short to the point. I don't feel like there's a bad song on there, and maybe for me, because it's the first album I ever played on, that it, you know, was all new and exciting for me.
Yeah, I remember Larry saying that we were definitely trying to come in on a small budget, and we were worried that the amount of money we're spending, which was like $900, would exceed like the profit the record would bring in. I often talk about the one show I remember where it just seemed like it was almost overnight. I mean, we had put in a lot of hard work in. I mean, Ben and I had been going from like 86 already. But I remember that. Do you remember that show? In I think it was Philadelphia, where it was this grungy bar and it looked like no one was going to be there. They had a horrible sound system. And then all of a sudden they were like 300 kids that showed up and started singing yeah. our songs. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I mean, that was always a trip. Even my first show at McGregor's whenever we played Gilman, I was always really amazed because, you know, I think people just assumed that we played in front of hundreds and hundreds of people all the time. But I remember the first show that we played on the tour going to record My Brain Hurts, played in a living room in Minnesota. And I want to say there was about 13 people there. And I think there were probably more people outside not wanting to listen to us than the people that were in there. And it's always funny when people are like, oh, yeah, you guys probably, you know, played big clubs. And no, we had our share of playing living rooms. And I can't remember which city in Montana we were billed as Screaming Eagle.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, the Screaming Eagles.
Yeah. Like, oh, that's really heartening.
I talked to Larry about the recording of it, and I had some frustrations in it, but it went pretty smoothly. But what I remember is that we really did do it live. And
yeah.
I remember getting frustrated a few times that I couldn't hear you or couldn't hear Ben. Do you remember any of that actual time period in the recording studio?
A little bit. I just remember being kind of nervous once the recording button went on, like, okay, don't screw this up. One thing I do remember when we finally got all the guitar, bass, and drum sounds, I think the four of us were just noodling around, and we'd been like for like 10, 15 minutes, and then Ben and Larry and Andy Ernst were all in the control room, and I thought, huh, I wonder if there's something wrong in the mixing room. So I stopped playing and I walked in there and you guys continued playing. Walked in and I said, hey guys, is everything okay? You know, I'm ready to play. And Larry got up and hugged me. He's just like, thank you so much. They've just been listening to us just pretty much wanking for 10, 15 minutes. And I'm like, shouldn't we get this going? And I distinctly remember it. He was like, oh, thank goodness. but I don't remember there being any real frustrations as far as the recording. I remember it going pretty smooth, and I know that time was of the essence because we did have a small budget. I hadn't, you know, so I was really cognizant of not wanting to waste time. I'm still like that when I go into the recording studio.
Yeah, we were pretty well rehearsed. I mean, that's one thing about that band that I've always been since, is I always go in pretty well rehearsed. Even if you know you're going to experiment with a few songs, you have to have that foundation, you know, solidified.
Yeah, I'm sure if you're a band that's got a gigantic recording budget, the jamming in the studio is probably something that would be interesting. But for me, that just seems like that would be a waste of time and money. You know, and it wasn't like we were trying to split the atom with the music or anything. It was, you know, it was straightforward pop punk sort of thing.
Do you know? You know what you just reminded me of? I think it wasn't you. It was you and I that were dropped off at the Ashtray, right? Not knowing anybody. Well, I remember us being almost frightened. Remember, what's his face was like spitting like Flynn balls onto the ceiling, and I remember you and I just looking at each other. It was like a whole new world for us.
Yeah, I wasn't used to people spitting Flynn balls on walls in the place that they were living in. Because I always thought, like, well, if you do that, you're the one that has to clean it up. I remember being a little intimidated. And I felt, wow, I'm really not that punk rock.
yeah, I thought that too. Well, I thought what was interesting is, you know, we've seen other punk houses before, but if I'm not mistaken, there were people from Isocracy living there and Crimp Shrine, and I think Jesse was like living in a hole somewhere around there.
I think Aaron Comic Bus was living in this little, I guess it was their little laundry room, but it was like this really tiny room, and he's a tall guy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow. And he'd be in there writing, or, you know, he'd be off doing something. One thing I do remember staying there was early in the morning. I was in my sleeping bag and the sun was pounding in my face, and I saw someone walk past me, and I kind of looked up bleary-eyed, and I saw the Unity patch on the back of the jacket, and I knew who it was. I thought, oh my God, that's Liv from Mop Ivy. So I was all excited. I'm like, wow, I gotta meet this guy. So I jumped out of my sleeping bag, and I went up to say hello to him, and he just looked at me, and he said, are you on drugs? And I just remember, like, a little crestfallen, like, oh man, no. Oh. It just woke up. So it was, I mean, it's kind of funny looking back at it now, but at first I was like, oh, this isn't some mecca of punk love or anything like that. So it was kind of funny. I wasn't expecting that reaction.
Which tour was that where you and me ended up on the bus?
That was at the end of that tour.
Was it? It was actually on that tour?
Yeah. I remember Bob, who is the singer of Ivy League, he had bought a van a couple of years ago for $70.
I thought he got it for a dollar.
$70.
$70. I think he was saying a dollar.
And I remember the gear shift on there where there was like this inch radius around the whole gear shift where there was no floor. And I just remember being really nervous when we're going on the freeways. I was waiting for a little stone or pebble to, like, pop through there and just, you know, zigzag all over the interior of the van like a bullet or something. But luckily that didn't happen. But the van crapped out in the East Bay, and when we were staying at the punk house, and we didn't have the money to repair the transmission on it. It would have been more expensive than the van it was itself. So we decided to leave the van there. And I think one of the guys living there, Jux was going to be going out to Chicago and dropping off merchandise for the band Monsula. And so Dan and Ben rode with him to Chicago, and I took apart my drum kit so it could fit in the trunk. And luckily in those days, I didn't have drum cases. And then the rest of us took Greyhounds home, and we each took a guitar and an amp on the bus with us. And I remember having $5 to my name for that two-day trip. I'll never forget it. That lady across from us, like everything, like the whole trip, no matter where we went, she ended up sitting across from us. Then the two really obese guys in front of us, we started to smell after 10 hours. And I remember being so hungry, and again, only $5 to my name. And I know that $1.25 of it was going to be needed for the bar ride to your house once we got to the Greyhound terminal in Chicago. I remember these guys, whenever we'd go stop off for food somewhere, it's like some Kentucky hut out in the middle of nowhere, and they'd be bringing bags of food onto the bus, and just this wafting stench of food, and I was so hungry, like, oh my God, oh, this smells so good. And yeah, just remember those guys smelling rather rank.
I chose My Brain Hurts out of the records for us because of it. Actually is the most popular, and it had a lot of those memories of us first getting together, I think, which are great. But I also have, like, Wiggle for me was where I felt like we as a band sort of bonded more. I remember we just had these rehearsals where you and me and Lise Vapp, and I think Johnny Personality was in the band then. And we would just go for hours sometimes. You know, Ben would eventually leave and we'd just keep playing. That's one of the few times in my life where I actually like being involved in that sort of, you know, where we just sort of jammed.
Yeah, I think it was kind of nice. I think we just kind of needed it. Because I think there was such pressure to try to follow up My Brain Hurts. I think we all felt it. And I felt recording Wiggle was, for me, a lot more tense than it was for My Brain Hurts. I remember almost quitting playing music during the sessions of Wiggle, because there was this drum fill that I just couldn't get, like the sticking, and I kept hitting the sticks, and I'd lose the drum fill, and I think we did four or five takes of the song, and I just couldn't get it. And for me, four or five takes was three or four too many. I was really critical of my drumming, and still am. You know, I didn't want to waste other people's time, so I got really frustrated that this was taking multiple takes. And I remember Mass saying, let's go take a time out. And I remember the Sonic Iguana Studios being near a golf course. And I think I sat on one of the holes staring into the sky for about 10, 15 minutes, wondering if I should just pack it in and tell you guys, you know what, I'm done. Because I was so disappointed that it was taking me a long time to get this drum part. That was that's the thing I remember most about it.
Yeah, I think we all really put the pressure on ourselves after My Brain Hurts came out. But I still, yeah, I have a lot of good memories still tied to Wiggle. I just felt it was the one time where we were all contributing parts that I was excited about.
Definitely. It was, I mean, there were some really, really good aspects to it. But I think for me...
Once we got to the studio is when it got
Yeah, exactly.
Real.
And like I said, I think everyone just kind of felt... Like, oh, we've got a one-up My Brain Hurts, which I think probably in hindsight, we should have just looked at it as a different album and not worried about it so much. Another thing that I remember about the bus ride back from Oakland to Chicago, I remember it was like 2, 3 in the morning, and I heard this noise, like a bunch of rocks or something going back and forth on the floor. It was like... I'm like, what the hell is that? And even people around us were like, what the hell is that? Are you going into your backpack? And you're like, uh-oh. This, like, chuckle to yourself. He showed me because you bought lemon heads.
Oh,
earlier.
That's right. I thought they were Skittles. You're right. They were lemon heads.
And you showed me what was probably once a near full box, completely empty. So it'd be 4 or 5 hours of this back and forth lemon head jingle on the floor.
Do you remember most about that memory is, everyone was annoyed, even more so than they were annoyed at that lady. But then we stopped, and I thought they were going to, like, clean out the bus, and I was like, oh, finally, my guilt gets to go away. And I remember you and I got back on, and, like, after 5 minutes, he made, like, a turn, and you could hear them all go,
they're probably still on the bus to this day.
They just deal with it because they're feeling so horrible on that bus anyway. They're just like, it might as well just sound horrible too.
Yeah, well, I think I've never been on a Greyhound bus before, and that was a hell of a way to be introduced to Greyhound. And from that day on, I referred to Greyhound as America's Most Wanted on Wheels.
Didn't the bus driver leave somebody too?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember that. He just left him. And everyone's like, hey, there's this guy. And he just kept driving.
It's like some of those experiences on that bus for that 50-hour journey. It's like scars in my brain. I just remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah. It's funny to me how those, they still become like special memories. To me, like, I would not erase that memory for anything. I mean, even though it was so horrible living it, it's actually one of my funnier memories of our time together.
You know, and that's the thing about touring is you're kind of emotionally on autopilot. And you just, I think when you're in the middle of touring, you're experiencing all these things with all these different people. And you just assume, like, oh, another day, get up, drive, play a show. You know, it's kind of like Groundhog Day. And it's not until you come back from tour, you don't see each other for like a week or so, and you all end up getting together at someone's at a party or some sort of get-together, and you see each other and like, oh, remember this and remember that? And people just look at you gobsmacked, like, I can't believe you guys went through that. You know, you start talking about these experiences and these people, and then you realize right then and there, like, oh, my God. We survived. Yeah. And at the time, you just think it's, you know, get up, drive, play a show, go to sleep, get up, drive, play a show. And it's not until, I think, after the fact. It's probably the body's way of just dealing with the stress and the absurdity. Like, okay, we're not going to think about it. When you get home, we'll let you unwind. Yeah, I always thought that was really interesting. It wasn't until we got home and you realized, wow, we survived that.
Yeah, no one can take that away.
Yeah, I don't think they'd want to. You can have it.
You can have that memory. I don't need it.
And I always thought that was interesting. People like, oh, you guys are a bunch of rock stars, you know? And like, really? If you went through a fraction of some of the things that some of the people in bands go through, they'd be crying home. Because, you know, it is really an amazing experience. But you do encounter some really extreme highs and lows, and you really find out what you're made of when you're put through that experience.
Yeah. And I think even doubly hard and courageous and stupid of us was to attach, like, recording records to these tours, too.
Yeah.
I think it was great because you can feel the energy in those albums, but that's nuts.
Yeah. Well, I remember we tried doing that with Anthem for A New Tomorrow, and I think at that point we went to Sonic Iguana to record it, and I think Vapid had the flu. I think we're all just exhausted and sick. I think we ended up doing two takes of two songs, and it just sounded horrible. And we just sounded exhausted and just not very interested. And we decided to go home and postpone it and record another time.
Yeah, I remember. I remember getting home and just sleeping for like 2 days straight after that. Because I think, yeah, we had just finished a tour and we went directly to Mass's studio to record, and it failed.
Yeah. So work for my brain hurts, not so much for Anthem.
Yes.
But luckily it wasn't set in stone that we had to record Anthem at that given time. So that was a blessing.
Yeah,
because otherwise that album, the energy would have been just horrid.
Had a good run there for a while. I have another interview soon, but is there any last things that you'd want to say about that, specifically that record or songs on it, or just about
No, I think for me, it's probably my favorite Screeching Weasel album, and I was really grateful to be a small part of the band for when I was in it. Like I said, I didn't have any expectations of becoming a drummer in any capacity. So it was a really nice surprise, and it was a great band.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement Subgenre Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests, this time with Dan Panic from way back in October of 2012. I am now heading off to Japan for another year to do some wizardry in Osaka. I will be finishing up the podcast for the Smoking Popes and probably taking on a few more while I am in Osaka, because I tend to have more time to do interviews when I'm there. I'll also be exploring doing a couple episodes on some of the Japanese bands that I met and was lucky enough to play with while I was there before and while I will be there again. Also, remember to please, please, please try to donate to our Patreon. I just had some really nice Jughead's Basement's shirts made for the $5 donators. If you donate $5 from anywhere from 6 months to a year and you live in the States, you will receive a shirt after that 6 months. But if you live outside of the States, I will probably contact you and ask if it's worth you paying the extra cash to actually have one sent to you. I just made all that up in the moment, and that seems about right. Also, you can do a one-time donation. Just go to PayPal and put in jugheadsbasement@gmail.com and just give us some money. I'll take it. We'll take it. My people that helped me edit this, Jason and Paul, will be glad to take it. I would like to pay them more. They do quite a bit of work for me. And actually, Paul doesn't even have a computer anymore, so this is not the Paul Russell. It's another Paul. But I'm hoping we can get him some sort of editing device sometime in the future so that he can get back to working with us. That's it. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening. And hopefully I will have more of these coming more sooner than later in the future, which is almost now. Thank you. Good days.